About a month ago, Perspective heard from Robert Murray, who explained his plan to build an anaerobic digester and energy hub at Andrus. Just over a week ago, a group of farmers and government officials visited Scotland to see how AD plants work. I joined them as an independent observer, and this week's programme gives a fascinating insight into how energy crops and an AD plant could work for the Isle of Man. First, we hear from Andrus farmer Sam Murray.
Come on this trip, because the industry is struggling. There's no markets coming along. There's no futures to provide comfort and confidence to reinvest. The markets, like you say, you're trying to move commodity things at the moment, such as grain or livestock, and the markets in the UK aren't the best on the grain side with the costs of shipping. So we want to have something local. Why can't we have something local? And that's the main thing. Finding a new market where for the next 20, 30 years, there's confidence and room to expand.
Yeah.
It's like I say, I'm 30, by the time this is released, I'll be 31 years old, and there's not a lot to look forward to for the next 20 or 30 years, whereas this provides really exciting opportunities.
And your dad is, of course, the kind of the moving force behind this. Are there times where you have wondered whether he's basically barking up the wrong tree, wasting his time?
We have had one or two father-son discussions throughout this journey. May or may not have said that this isn't going to go any further. We've hit a brick wall. There's no way around this. And each time we seem to have found an air brick and we've got through to the next part. And it's frustrating, because as youth, we can see what we want. We want to be involved in the industry. We want to push it forward. And to have handcuffs, one arm behind your back, is very, very tricky. And that can be quite demoralising at times. But you don't think about that. You just think, well, we've got to keep pushing forward to try and make our businesses vibrant and successful, frankly.
That was farmer Sam Murray. Next, we hear from James and Ian, who operate the first AD plant we visited in Scotland.
Hello, I'm James Campbell Adamson, Managing Director of Strathcather Estates.
Yeah, we've always historically been arable. We've had a bit of livestock over the years, but about 7 years ago, we got approached by an investor looking for a site, and they were motivated by a site that was close to the main gas pipeline, which we are, the main gas pipeline that runs down from Aberdeen towards Dundee and Perth. And they wanted to have someone that had the scale and the energy to be able to transform their operations to help out for this business.
And it's quite unusual in as much as your farm supplies the whole of the feedstock for the plant.
Yes, so we've got the benefit here of having the scale, and we grow now 70% of the crops that we grow as a farming business get sold to the plant, which amounts to about 40,000 tonnes of feed every year that we produce for them.
And effectively, you get paid for what you produce.
Yeah, basically, we have a weighbridge, which we've just stood next to, and we get paid for the weight of the crops that we produce every year. And we produce crops every month of the year, so we've got a harvesting team out every month of the year, which is quite rare. You know, traditionally, you're out for 3 months over the summer bringing your wheat and barley in. We're cutting crops all year round, so we have a steady flow of trucks coming in with our crops, which then also means a steady flow of income for the crops that we're producing.
The other thing, of course, is the price. You tell me, are you guaranteed a price, or how long into the future do you know what prices you're going to get?
Yeah, well, that was the real beauty of this when we looked at it about 7 years ago, was, you know, the traditional form of agriculture now is, you know, you put your crops in the ground with no idea what you're going to get paid for it that year. I have crops on the ground at the moment, the wheat and the barley, and we don't know what we're going to get paid for it in a few months, let alone a few years. The real attraction of this operation was we were entering into a 20-year growing contract, inflation linked, so we knew what we're going to get paid day one, but I also know what we're going to get paid year 10, year 20, which that really allowed us to be able to business case it, because there was a big investment from day one. A lot of new machinery we had to buy. It was about 2 million of new machinery we had to buy on day one, which you couldn't justify if you didn't know what you were going to get paid for it. So we were able to look at the income over the next 10 years and be able to justify that cost.
And a lot of people listening might be quite surprised to learn that farmers would even contemplate sowing crops if they had no idea how much the price was?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the price of wheat at the moment is a massive fluctuating commodity. You know, we're seeing at the moment it's down for us about £175 a tonne. About this time last year, it was about £220 a tonne. And you know, we've seen global economics really impacting it. The war in Ukraine spiked the price up. But then now there's generally around the world good harvest this year, so the price has really come down. If you're just producing wheat and relying on the commodity market, it's a real risk at the moment because prices drop below 170 ton or so, you'll be losing out on your crop.
One of the debates, the inevitable debates about all this, is that you are effectively taking productive arable land out of food production effectively to produce energy crops, and there's an argument that says, well, farmers should be producing food. What would you say in response to that?
We hear that a bit, but I'd say traditionally we've never produced food really for human consumption directly. A lot of what we used to grow was for the whiskey market, and actually I hear there is a food crisis, but there's also an energy crisis in this country, and there's people are paying more and more for their energy bills, and there needs to be a more of a push towards more sustainable sources of energy, and that's what we're doing at the moment.
And, well, how many years have you been operating?
We, as a business, as a family here, we've been here for a couple of hundred years. It's a purely family-owned business. This site here has been about 7 years. We've now been operating here. And we're producing enough energy at the moment to feed about 4,000 homes for their gas, which is a real different operation. And it's great to feel that what we're doing here is actually directly impacting 4,000 homes that are now no longer as reliant on fossil fuels for their gas.
And how many acres?
Overall, as a business, we're at 4,000 acres, and about 70% of that is for this site.
So three quarters of an acre per house, basically.
Well, yeah, you're better at me at maths, but yeah, about that, yeah. Yeah, put it that way.
7 years in, then, if you could go back 7 years, what would you do differently?
Well, good question. It's definitely taken a few years to get the site working well. It's really considering it as, we always say, as a concrete cow. You know, we feed enough crops, the equivalent of what you'd feed 2,000 dairy cows. So I think really treating it like a cow, which we may have not done from the day one. So really being sensitive on the crops that are going in, treating it all like a stomach, not ramping up too much from day one. Be considerate of changing the crops very gradually. So we grow sugar beet here, which is quite unique. We only grow that for about 6 months of the year, so we ramp it up very slowly. So day one on the sugar beet, we're putting in literally one tonne of sugar beet, ramping that up to about 50 tonnes a day. So being very gentle on it, but also being considerate of, as it is a concrete cow, what goes in comes out. So we put 40,000 tonnes of crops in every year, and about 40,000 tonnes of digestate comes out the back of it, just like a cow. And you can see from here, you can see it actually coming out the back. And maybe we didn't quite consider the impact of that. It's great. It's real rich nutrient stuff that comes out the back, and we spread that in the fields. So everything that comes out goes back in again. So it's a real closed nutrient cycle here. But maybe we didn't quite realize the impact of that. That's a pretty much full-time job for someone every year to be removing that.
And as in terms of neighbours, I mean, you haven't got many close neighbours that I've seen yet, but have there been any concerns from neighbours? I mean, are there any smells associated or anything like that?
No, so we're purely clean crops here. So some AD plants are taking in waste from council waste or from poultry waste, and that gives us a smell. But I think you'll see from your visit today, your smell from your visit today, there is no real smell from it. It's all quite a clean crop coming off. And we had no real planning objections. And I think people in the local area recognise it as a positive. And what this is doing also for the local community is it allows us to be able to reinvest in our staff here. We're reinvesting in the roads and the infrastructure around the area. And we can guarantee to be able to support the team here and reinvesting in our employees, which I think then benefits the local community.
Ian Wilson, farms manager here at Stracathro Estate. We're based just for those that know Scotland, we're based just outside Brechin, but basically we're kind of halfway between Dundee and Aberdeen.
And this is a massive operation that you're in charge of. What are the hurdles to actually making this work?
In Scotland, weather. So here at Strathcarter, we've got 4,000 acres. Roughly 2,500 of that goes into the AD plant here, and 1,500 through conventional farming. But yeah, we are at the mercy of the elements here. Scotland, when it's good, it's great. When it's bad, it's horrible. So that's kind of a real challenge, particularly on the AD side. You know, further south, you would be growing maize. We can't grow maize up here, so grass silage, we can grow grass well. Rye, good years, we can get very, very good rye, but it can be a bit challenging. Sugar beet, again, it's great feedstock for the AD plant, but frost is as much a challenge as anything up here. So, yeah, we farm. You know, standing here in the sunshine today, it doesn't feel like it, but we get our fair share, and like everywhere else with climate change, it's extremes that are now becoming more of an issue. We're standing here, we've had the previous year we could hardly get going because of the rainfall, and now we're standing a year later and it's the opposite. We can hardly get crops to grow because it's so dry. So yeah, you know, it's just these extremes that seem to be causing more and more of an issue. For us, it was about long-term sustainability, and by having this AD plant on our site, we were managed to negotiate a 20-year feed contract, so I know what I'm getting paid every year before I even start. And don't get me wrong, some years there's the odd year where commodity prices go sky high, maybe I'm losing, but I think, you know, for us it's about knowing we're making profit. It's not about profit maximisation that 1 year out of five, it's about that sustainability and that, you know, that ability to invest in machinery, invest in staff, invest in the estate itself, knowing that this is not a one-off making profit this year. We are going to be profitable for the next 10, 15, 20 years, which allows us to sort of keep investing rather than this sort of boom or bust that most farming seems to be in. I think for me, the AD plant is probably about as close as we're ever going to get to the old-fashioned rotation without livestock on the farm. So we're farming 4,000 acres here. Historically, you know, I'm talking 20-25 years ago, we ran 600 suckler cows and 2,000 ewes on the estate. You know, the old system where you did cereals, you did livestock, you had a bit of everything, and you kind of, that was your way of sort of sheltering from the highs and the lows. Agricultural specialised, and we're very much an arable farm here. Because we went out of stock 20 years ago, we don't have the fences, we don't have the staff, we don't have the skills to, you know. We noticed after a few years of no livestock in the estate that everything was deteriorating. You know, the soils weren't as good healthy as they were, the crop yields were reducing, and we were at a crossroads. Do you go and re-fence everything? Do you get back in? Well, once you've got out, it's very expensive to get back in. In this part of the world, finding good quality staff to run livestock, that's a challenge in itself. Economics, okay, cattle are making, cattle and sheep are probably as profitable just now as they've ever been, but 10 years ago that was a different story. So I think the AD plant gave us that ability to have that old-fashioned rotation. You know, we're bringing in grass back into the rotation, we're bringing in numerous crops that allows us to have a really wide rotation without needing the fences, needing the stockmen. I've got arable tractormen here, and I think a real challenge in a lot of farms now is this, as farms specialise. We've got guys that are really good on tractors, really technically gifted on the arable side. Do they want to spend their whole winter bedding cattle? No. Are they geared up for it? No. So, you know, we don't have that coming out on a Saturday morning, you know, expecting a guy to work hard all harvest on an arable side and then, oh, by the way, well done, that's job one done. You've now got to feed and bed cattle all winter. You know, it removed that need to have that sort of separate enterprise on the business.
One of the things you were telling us was the most important thing. One of the most important things is keeping your staff happy, and there's a coach load of farmers and people from the Isle of Man waiting for their dinner, so I think it's probably time we ended the interview.
Yep, no, thanks very much for coming to see us. It was a great honour to host you, and I wish you all the very best with what's in store for this AD plant project.
Jim Booth is the Cooperative Development Director of the Scottish Agriculture Organisation Society.
So we are the experts, the UK experts, in farm cooperation and supply chain collaboration. And we are a co-op ourselves. So we are a co-op ourselves, thus the name Society. And we are owned by 55 members. So these are farmer co-ops mostly in Scotland, some are in England, but collectively they have a combined throughput of 1.5 billion and 25,000 members. Co-ops right through the history of mankind, you know, people have worked together, people have cooperated, and perhaps in a, you know, as we move to 21st century, people have forgotten about cooperation and are more individual. But basically, a co-op is people working together to do something they can't do alone. So in farming terms, it's back to the old neighbouring that we used to do, people, which we call informal cooperation, sharing equipment, sharing land, helping each other, caring for the community.
And of course, a lot of people listening to the programme probably won't realise just what individual farmers are up against when it comes to trying to compete in the food production sector.
Exactly, Phil. And it's all about power. And so when you think about agriculture, the majority of agriculture is working in the food and drink supply chain. And if you think about that supply chain, it's dominated by the multiple retailers. So these are the supermarkets that we all of us buy most of our food products, grocery products from our supermarkets. It's just so convenient. But they exert huge power just because of their scale and their size. So they dictate the terms down that supply chain. Then you have the processors, which more and more, these are consolidated into multinationals. So these are organizations which don't even, you know, have a head office in the UK or in Isle of Man. They operate internationally. And again, they are huge businesses, again, huge power. And then at the bottom of that supply chain is the poor farmers, which are very, very small. And then therefore they are price takers. They are just simply price takers. And the only way we can try and combat that is by farmers working together to try and combat that fragmentation, to try and influence the market. And that's one of the benefits of cooperation.
And that's not always as easy as it sounds, is it? Because many farmers, well, I think most farmers have great pride in the way in which they run their relatively small farm businesses, and trying to get them to recognise that perhaps what they're doing, it may be very good in certain circumstances, but it may not necessarily meet the goals and objectives of the cooperative.
Exactly. And what the benefits of cooperation, basically it's a no-brainer. And, you know, we struggle to find why a farmer wouldn't cooperate. In Scotland, our cooperation rates are high. Over half of farmers in Scotland are involved in a co-op, both as a formal cooperation, as a member, or informal cooperation, sharing bits of equipment and labour with neighbours. But that still is less than the continent. In the continent, over 70%, 80% of farmers are a member of a co-op. Same in Ireland as well. So cooperation, farm cooperation, just dominates agriculture. And so the benefits for a farmer in the Isle of Man are very simple. Economies of scale, so it lowers the costs of their inputs. It gives them market access to any of their produce. It results in higher prices because of that bargaining power. It saves them time, takes hassle away. The big one nowadays is uncertainty, risk uncertainty, and shocks, you know, in the markets. That's just a feature of the world we live in today. So it's a great way. In fact, the only way to manage that risk and uncertainty is through cooperation. So it builds resilience in farms. You know, if something happened because of the weather or illness or something, it allows you to build resilience. And it, importantly, and that's a big distinction, it co-op supports rural communities. If you think of other businesses, what they do is they leak the profits away to external shareholders, while a co-op will keep the surplus, the profit, in the community. So it doesn't go away to the city, it doesn't go away to London or wherever the company is registered. It keeps them in the community. So it's really, really important. Co-ops, we talk about co-ops having multiple bottom lines, and a big part of that, it's all about people, and it's about the community that they operate in as well.
particularly, I mean, this trip was about all about looking at and understanding how anaerobic digestion plants work. It seemed pretty obvious that from a the plant owner, plant operator perspective, having a cooperative supplying seemed to be a particularly good thing. Why are so many of the plants apparently supplied by cooperatives?
Well, there's a number of benefits for both parties, you know, the farmer suppliers, so that's supply co-op, but obviously the biogas, the AD plant operator. So the first thing about the supply co-op, a feedstock supply co-op, is they would manage that relationship with the biogas operator. And that has to be a partnership. It has to be a partnership. So it's really important they work together, have common goals, share the benefits and the risks, because what success is about driving efficiency to make sure that AD plant is as efficient as possible. So that's one of the secrets of success for any future plant, is that relationship. The supply co-op always, remember, would represent members. So they would plan and manage the feedstock harvesting and the digested spreading. They'd coordinate and manage the contractors who do all the sort of key specialist work, but also the logistics management. So that's a bit about the co-op doing the logistics management to make sure that the movement of materials is done efficiently, to lessen the impact on the communities it impacts as well, but also from an economic point of view. But apart from that, the co-op would also, and that's a big part of cooperation, and it's part of the seven principles, is about training and education. And so they will help the members about how do you produce the feedstocks. So you have your fast track in the learning. So you develop blueprints for growing the crops, be it maize, sugar beet, or forage rye, whatever. And you would conduct field-scale trials, knowledge transfer events, so people don't make the same mistakes and everybody's running efficiently. So it's, again, I go back to that. It's a no-brainer why you would form a co-op.
Forming co-ops, it sounds like a relatively straightforward thing. You know, you know that you want a certain quality of product. You know that you want to work collaboratively to produce it and to get it to the AD plant. It's not hard, is it? We could set one up tomorrow.
Well, that is true in a sense that the business structure, you know, your legal business structure is relatively easy. But what you have to do, there's a number of steps involved before you make that. And the most important one is ensuring you have a commercial opportunity. And so when people ask us, you know, can you help us form a co-op? We ask that on a regular basis. The first thing we'll say to them is, well, do you have a commercial opportunity? And normally that part, the research part, is weak. And so we help people look at that. So looking at the research, the market research, the feasibility study, developing a business plan to make sure you've got a viable business. Because without an economic viable business, you know, no business, whether it's a co-op or not, will survive. So that's the first thing. Then you need that leadership group. So you need local leaders in the community who people respect to give the project credibility amongst the farming population. So that's really important. And then the next step, and something you've talked about, Phil, is about having a common purpose. So you have to develop a common purpose so there is clarity of what is the purpose of the co-op. And it's written down and it's very clear. So then you go through that business planning stages. And then the important bit is preparing a prospectus. So you hold open meetings, you produce a prospectus so that anybody who's interested can make a decision. You know, do I want, because it's an individual decision. That's one of the benefits of cooperation, is it's open and voluntary. And so it's an individual decision for farming businesses. Do I want to join or not? So what's the pros and cons, and what's my commitment? And then once you get that and you have sufficient interest to form a co-op, then you proceed to form the co-op. So there's these key steps that are involved in forming a co-op. And normally, it depends on the business, but I would say it takes 6 months to a year to go through that steps to make sure everybody's clear what's involved and what's their commitment, and they've just done everything. You know, it's a rigorous business proposal.
And what are the warnings, the examples that you've seen where things have not worked out the way that they should have done? Are there any obvious glaring errors that tend to result in failures of cooperatives?
Well, that's a thing. And I want to sort of dispel that myth as well, Phil, that people talk about the failures in co-ops, especially in farming communities, and say, well, co-ops fail. But that's not the truth. Because when you look at the statistics, the failure rates of co-ops is half that of conventional businesses. So, and that's just a fact. You know, when you analyze the statistics of business failures, co-ops failure rate is half that of conventional businesses. But your point is important about, well, what are the reasons if a failure, you know, if there is a failure. And the reality is it's the business structure isn't the issue, it's people who fail. It's people who fail, and it's a failure of governance. And I know governance isn't a sexy topic and people don't understand it, but what governance means is how decisions are made. And so one of the biggest issues for cooperatives is a lack of understanding by the people involved. And that's why training is very important for the directors, for the staff, for members, so they really understand the co-op difference, what's involved, and the co-op values and these principles about cooperation, which are internationally agreed and written down. So these are really really important. So when we look at failures of co-ops or co-ops who are not performing well, it comes down to a failure of governance. And it's that bit about engaging with members. Because remember, with a co-op, the member owns the business. So that's a big difference. They are the owner of the business and the user of the service. And for them to feel like the owner of the business, they have to feel engaged. So you have to communicate with them. You have to engage with them. You have to ask their view. Because again, one of the principles of cooperation is one member, one vote. And therefore, there's democracy there. And so they have a voice. But you have to allow people to get engaged to do that.
I suppose the final question then, particularly in relation to the growing of energy crops, you know, there are concerns here that the Isle of Man agricultural sector should be engaged in food production. And quite frankly, energy is an unnecessary luxury in terms of growing energy crops. Presumably, that's an argument that you've heard plenty of times in Scotland too.
Yes. But I would argue the production of land, the putting land down to produce green energy, is a good use of land. I mean, I would argue against that because we have responsibility to address the climate challenge. You know, it's there. So we all know that. But the other point is, in reality, what food is being produced by that land? And in many cases, it's overestimated. And so you really have to challenge that argument and say, well, what food is being produced with that land? But if you went into any green energy production, it's really important. It's, you know, it supports, it's a good use of land. It supports a vibrant local farming community, which is really important because it gives them an economic boost, you know, because it is a very profitable business for them to get involved in. It produces green energy, as I said, for the local community. So, for example, a 4-megawatt biogas, AD biogas plant will supply enough energy for 4,000 homes, both electric and gas. So that means the community, the island, becomes more self-reliant for future energy shocks, which we've all experienced in the last few years as well. But the other thing about supporting this project as well, it's actually good for soil health and it's good farming practice because of the digestate. It's actually good for the environment, good for the soil. And actually it results in less use of purchased fertilizers, which all have to be important in Thailand. So there's loads of reasons why I would argue It's good use of land use, and the community should support it.
And the other concern about growing energy crops is the argument, well, how green really is this? Because there's an awful lot of carbon by way of fertilizer and fuel that has to be spent to produce the energy crop at the end of it.
Well, again, as I said before, Phil, that the fertilizer, most of that fertilizer will be coming from the digested. So, and again, if you have a two megawatt biogas plant, that would need 40,000 tons of feedstock. But whatever feedstock you put in, you will have 40,000 tons of digested. But that digested has a good nutrient value, and it's a great soil improver. It's a fantastic soil improver. So the reality is you have less requirement for fertilizer in the future. And again, it's a very efficient in terms of capturing the biomethane, all sorts of uses for the biomethane, as we know, for electric or for gas or for future, for powering vehicles. You know, you could actually power tractors. So in Germany, the biogas plants in Germany are used to power the vehicles supporting the biogas plant. Mm-hmm. So the engines are developed to be fueled not by diesel, but by green energy, by biomethane from the plants themselves. So and actually, it's a closed loop. We talk about a closed loop. So it's a closed loop because it's just a circle of energy, and it's very, very efficient.
And of course, that's particularly important for the Isle of Man, where anything that you do need by way of an input, and indeed the fossil fuels that fuel the machines, all of that has to be imported.
Exactly. And it's just, the economics is just crippling the island, really. You know, it's 50, 60, 70 pounds a ton to bring in anything in, equally to export anything, you know. And it's just, you know, agriculture. Well, a number of farmers have said to me, agriculture is on its knees. And so it needs a boost. And this is one way it can boost the farming community on the island.
Newly elected Andrus Commissioner David Bolton was interested to learn more about what could be a big development in Andrus. The AD plant that's being proposed is in Andrus. What are the concerns or what's the interest of the commissioners?
Well, I think looking forward over the next 4 years, it's quite could possibly be one of the biggest things that we have to deal with in terms of what people in the village want to know about it. And the idea of coming on this is to allay some fears and answer the questions that some of people of Andrus might have.
And what do you think the concerns are of the people? I mean, I guess the obvious one is going to be smell, is it?
I think it's the biggest one, and at the previous public meeting that we had, that was the biggest question, really. And so far, on that front, it's been quite positive, I think. There was the AD we went to see yesterday, there was no more smell there than your average farm, to be honest. So from that point of view, it was very positive.
In fact, possibly even less, because there was no livestock, so no actual poo smells. The digestate, the stuff that comes out of the AD plant, didn't have much of a smell to it at all, really, did it?
No, it didn't. But it's also, apart from the smell, just been interesting to see how the plant actually operates and the digestate and all the different processes that are involved in it. It's been very interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah. And because, of course, the gas, the stuff that smells, the methane, the biogas, is what makes money for the operators. So the very last thing they want is leaky equipment that's allowing that gas out.
Yes, and it is a very big operator. There's more to it than I realised anyway. But I think that comes down to the operator. There seems to be... it's not just a case of putting it up there and just getting on with it. There's a lot involved in how it runs technically, and that's something that has to be ironed out, I suppose. But going forward, it looks very positive.
There will, I suppose, inevitably be some additional transport of feed crops to the site. Is that something you think that people in Andrus will have some concerns over?
I think even the people on this trip have shown concern about that, and that is something that if, as things progress and go move further, is definitely going to have to be discussed more, and it will be a concern for everybody, I think. But it's not something that hasn't happened before with the gravel and the sand from the sand pit over the years. There's been lots of traffic that goes through the village, and there might be things that we might have to do, certain roads that might maybe could be used, I don't know, but that's all things that will come out in the future, I'm sure.
And again, some of the people we've spoken to on the trip have already given us some hints as to how you can reduce the impact by ensuring that wagons or large trailers are not operating after 9 o'clock of an evening or whatever it may be. There are ways in which you can do this that allows for that kind of community respect, I suppose.
Yes, and I think everybody that's here has already thought about it. It's not like they're not thinking about what the possible impacts could be. So from that point of view, it's been very positive. And also, I've been quite impressed how invested all the farmers are in it, which was something I wasn't sure about how that was going to work. But everybody seems to be very positive about the whole thing. So it's really good, really good.
Hamish Nuttenball is responsible for running a large food and energy farm business in Scotland.
So I'm Hamish Nuttenball. I'm the arable manager at Peace Hill Farm here in Fife in Scotland.
And we've been looking round, first of all, the site, but also you've been telling us about the various cropping plans that you've got and the rotations that are used. I mean, obviously you do the AD stuff, you supply the feedstock for the plant. But what other crops do you grow?
So we're growing potatoes, brassica veg, so cauliflower, cabbage and broccoli, as well as cereals, and then obviously the AD crops, so that consists of rye, hybrid rye for whole crop harvest, and the energy beet. So we're harvesting the beet from October to March, April time, and the rye is all harvested in July.
And you've also got hens as well.
Yeah, so there's a broiler enterprise on site as well, producing broilers for a local factory just 20 miles away.
There are certain elements of what you do when you're producing the food where you need to get rid of the bits that are no use to you. So if you're sorting potatoes, you need to get rid of the potatoes that are damaged or green or not much use, and that kind of thing can come into the plant.
Yeah, exactly. So a prime example of that would be the chicken muck. So we're mucking out the chicken houses roughly every 7 weeks, and that's carted from the site, the chicken site, onto the AD plant, which is on the same site. And that's one of the main feedstocks for the AD plant. So as well as that, we've got waste potatoes, as you say, from the picking, the packing facility on the farm. Some waste potatoes come onto the AD plant. Some waste veg, which we can't sell. Yeah, just little bits and pieces. It's very, it works really well together, yeah.
And you also grow grain crops, some of which you can sell on in the commodity markets, others you can use as feedstocks as well.
Correct, yeah. So we're growing feed barley. A, because it fits our rotation, we'll put in spring barley behind, for example, a late harvested veg during the winter, and we'll harvest that feed barley and take it to the grain harvest, and it's fed into the AD plant once it's been processed in the fact it's been through a mill to be kind of rolled and milled. So yeah, feed barley would be another feedstock for approximately 10 tons a day. So yeah, over 3,500 tons of grain, which is grown and bought in from neighbours.
And you mentioned neighbours there. I mean, obviously there are neighbours, both domestic neighbours and farming neighbours. What are the issues for them?
I think at the start of the plant going in, there was question marks over utilising food production ground for energy crops. There was question marks over the smells, odours off the site, the digestate spreading, things like that. So there was a little bit of opposition, but to be honest, now the company's 10 years in and there's absolutely no conflict at all in the area. I think local farmers have really come on board with it, actually. So a lot of our close neighbours supply feedstock, so most of that would be hybrid rye, which they grow themselves and we come in and harvest it. Another tie-up would be the fact that they can take liquid or solid digestate from us, and I would say that we work pretty closely with neighbouring farms now.
And from a farming perspective, I suppose, again, most people listening to this programme won't really know that much about how farming businesses work, but farmers like to have several strings to their bow, don't they? They don't like to rely just on one or two crops.
Yeah, no, definitely. It spreads the risk, and I think the plants are more steady income stream in the fact that you're producing gas 365 days a year. Our other projects on the farm, we've got the veg, which is extremely volatile week to week, let alone month to month or years. We grow potatoes, which is volatile more on an annual basis. But yeah, it's strings to the bow, like you say. And actually, the crops all work very well together with the AD crops. So, for example, we could harvest energy beet in April and follow that with a really good crop of broccoli. Just the nutrition that the beet leaves leave behind in the ground would be a small example of then producing a good veg crop after that. Another example, as I mentioned, was the barley slotting in around later harvested crops. Quite an important part of our rotation is actually getting the rye harvested in July. That allows us a really early entry for cover crops. So we'd sow them in late July, early August, and, you know, put some roots down into our soil to kind of rejuvenate the soil, and then we would sow or plant a spring crop of energy beet or potatoes the following year. So I would say our rotation is kind of 50% energy crop and 50% food. And actually, I would say we produce more food here than a lot of neighbours in the fact we're growing broccoli, collie, cabbage, parsnips, carrots, potatoes, still alongside the energy crops.
And I guess the veg loves the digestate that you end up, you know, effectively the waste from the plant, which you can then go and spread on the land.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. So a byproduct from the plant is liquid and solid digestate, which is separated on the AD site. So the solid digestate, we cart that in bulk out to fields. We can stockpile it, and we generally spread that on the land at 25 tonnes a hectare, or roughly 10 tonnes an acre. Really good nutritional value in nitrogen, and especially potash. So our crops that we grow on the farm side are, they're actually quite hungry for potash, so potatoes, the rye, the veg, all big users of potash. It's just one big circle, really, putting that byproduct back on the land and growing food crops and energy crops to, you know, make use of that as well.
And compared with where you might have been if you were just producing the veg crop and you didn't have that digestate coming back, you'd be spending an awful lot of money on fertiliser.
Yeah, it's a huge cost saving on fertiliser inputs, so inorganic fertiliser inputs. There's huge savings there. And as I said, it's actually a very good fertiliser composition for the crops we grow. So yeah, cost saving. There's a little bit of cost and logistics involved in the spreading, but if you're well organised and weather's on your side, it's a very effective fertiliser for the crops we're growing.
What did the farmers get out of the visit? Andrus farmer Ned Kinnish has the final word.
Ned Kinnish from Ballyvaston Farm down in Andrews. And come over on this trip to sort of find a bit of inspiration, really. We've come up through Scotland here, probably the finest farmland anywhere in the British Isles, as far as I'm concerned. And it's highlighted to me what's actually happening on the Isle of Man, because our industry, I think, is declining pretty fast. When you come up through here, even if you take out the fact we're here to look at AD plants, even if you look at the countryside in general, it's busy, it's working. The land has worked right to the edge of the field, right every last corner is still farmed properly. Absolute credit to them up here. Whereas at home, yeah, I think the state of the countryside's slipping pretty fast, to be honest, and it's a shame to be a part of it, because once upon a time the island looked like this, and you can see there's money in the job. It's worth them farming it. There's money there to reinvest. I mean, I'd say, without shadow of a doubt, we're 20 years behind these guys now in terms of technology, in terms of investment. They're able to invest, therefore they're more efficient. We're not invested to the same stage. We're nowhere near as efficient. We're on the Isle of Man. We're at best, we're small fish in a small pond, and in my opinion, that small pond is drying out pretty fast.
And of course, I mean, inevitably, if you live in isolated parts of even the British Isles, you know, even UK, mainland UK, remote parts will not be doing quite as well as places like this. But of course, the added problem you've got with the island is getting all your inputs, buying in the fertiliser, and then shipping out the product.
That's exactly the problem at the minute, Phil, because we've got basically an oversupply of cereal on the island for the livestock that's there now, and this is a brilliant way of keeping that on the island, reducing it fertiliser requirements a huge amount. You still probably need to bring a bit of nitrogen in to go with it, but on the whole it would reduce it by, you know, a huge amount. And yeah, it's quite envious of it all, to be honest. Yeah, certainly am.
And it's a bit like old-fashioned farming. I mean, it's every AD plant operator we've spoken to on this trip has said it's like feeding a cow. And of course, it's not only like feeding the cow; it's also you get the output of the you get the energy, obviously, which you can sell, but you also get the waste from the plant, which is brilliant for fertility in the soil.
And I mean, we've got comparatively young soil on the Isle of Man, certainly on the north, where if this was to go ahead, you know, we're beast. We need to do everything we can to put as much back into it as possible, keep it fertile. But I mean, it's one thing you notice really quickly around here. This land is in good heart, and it is producing to the absolute maximum of its capacity, I would say. I'm really gobsmacked, to be honest, because no matter where I've gone throughout the UK, I've never seen a place as smart as this. And yeah, certainly that digestate going back of the ground does wonders for fertility. Yeah, and we're producing something which is it's different to our normal food production, isn't it? You know, we're not stuck with a commodity value, a world price. I mean, we've got wheat prices at the minute, barley prices at £170-180 a ton. I mean, barley's hardly trading it, it's worth that little. Whereas you know, these guys, they get it down to a certain value, they'll throw it through the digester and produce energy from it, and just give you a lot more options. Certainly been eye-opening anyway. Brilliant.
And messages to the various decision makers at home that might be listening to this program?
Yeah, open your eyes and ears and look at this hard, because you're putting money back into your local economy again. We shouldn't need to drive this home to them. You know, this should be what it's all about at the end of the day. If you're in government, you know, our money shouldn't be going off island, should be going back into this economy and into local business. I mean, also, it's going to generate considerable amount of employment off this as well, so knock-on effect there, I would say. And you're not upsetting anybody, are you? I mean, all the plants we've looked at today, you hardly know they exist. It's a bit different to a wind farm.
So what do you think? Would the Isle of Man benefit from an AD plant? It would certainly protect us from fluctuating energy costs, but would it help the government's ambition to reduce carbon emissions? There's a bonus AD agenda tomorrow if you want to learn more. Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting philgorn@manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. I'm Phil Gorn. Go to Myos and Geisiachrom. Thanks for listening.